Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit coderedroofers.com.
I want to walk, but I run back to you because I hate myself for loving you. People hate themselves for loving Donald Trump. I've decided that they're very shy about talking about it. Not me. Man, I love me some Donald Trump. I love the way he has exposed everything that I spent 30 years talking about. I kept saying, does anybody out there understand that, like, National Public Radio is so far to the left and believes that people like me are garbage? They have no respect for my opinions. Doesn't matter what kind of credentials I have. And the left does this all the time. I'm listening to the testimony on Capitol Hill, right? And you have some Democrat questioning our Surgeon General here in the state of Florida, Lodapo, and literally demeaning and trying to damage his credibility. Until finally Thomas Massie steps in and goes, wait a second, Dr. Lodapo, is it true that you have a degree in medical science and you're an MD as well, and you got those degrees at Harvard? To which Dr. Lodapo says, yes, that is true. And he says, and then Dr. Lodapo says, but I guess that's not enough. A great moment. I'll tell you what is another great moment. I wasn't there, but I got to watch it on X, Twitter, whatever it's called, was NPR trying to make sense of their CEO, who has literally posted things over the last couple of years which are so entirely leftist biased. They're not even just politically biased. They're just crazy leftist biased stuff, calling Trump a rapist and, you know, all this other stuff. And then they come up with, I love Christopher Rufo. You got to hand it to Chris Rufo. He comes up with a videotape, not hard to get, a TED Talk. I'm convinced that people think they're so slick when they get called up for a TED Talk and they go on and they say all these things on a TED Talk and the little lunatic left sits there and applauds and they feel like they're very special. Guess what? That lasts forever. He pulls up an old TED Talk where the current CEO of NPR is literally talking about how, Catherine Mayer is her name. She said, the First Amendment really gets in the way. Okay, I know. And this is a woman who's, you know, her mother is a state senator in Connecticut. Her father was the late Goldman Sachs executive, Gordon Roberts mayor. And she does a TED Talk where she talks about freedom of speech and says it's very inconvenient. The First Amendment's very inconvenient. And now she's the head of NPR. And now she's denying that Yuri Berliner, who wrote a piece on Free Press, my favorite Substack, and about to blow up and be the biggest Substack ever. It is already number one, but it's about to get even bigger. He writes an essay on the Free Press about how NPR has gone so far to the left that it has no respectability anymore. And they suspend him. It's not bad enough that he wrote only truths But then they suspend him because he didn't have their permission to write this article. Well, guess what? Whistleblowers don't ask for permission. And that's basically what he was doing, only in a journalistic manner. And I got to tell you, this is a 25-year veteran editor. A veteran editor. He's not like some low-level guy who just started out. He's been working at NPR for 25 years. And all he did was write an article on the Free Press saying, look, you know, this is really, at this point, we've damaged our own credibility by our coverage of, and then he lists the COVID and the Hunter Biden laptop. All things that we now know are true. You know, their coverage was so biased that they didn't tell the truth. Now, do I think they, I don't know what I think anymore. Do I think they set out to deceive the public? I do. I really do. That's how deep their bias is. It's like when I try to explain to people that no matter what they say to me and no matter how hard I try to like listen to them carefully, I don't understand why they hate Donald Trump so much. I just don't get it. Is it because he identifies with regular people? You know, this guy has more money than most people. And yet he goes to a bodega in Harlem and everybody's jumping around ecstatic, want to shake his hand. Why? Because he says, what's going on here? Every bodega in Harlem is getting robbed like twice a week. And the DA has come after me because, of course, I'm a bigger danger. And you listen to that. And I don't care what color you are. I don't care what age you are. You listen to that and you think about it for just 30 seconds and you go, that's true. What is this all about? Now, I want you to understand, because I have been waging this battle for 33 years. I have nothing against a liberal station existing. If you want to have a station that's filled with the left and the Democrat message, fine. But don't ask me to fund it. NPR is publicly funded. Not privately. I mean, there are private donors, big donors. But the government gives them money. So when you admit that your coverage is slanted, I would consider you a whistleblower. And I would afford you all the protection that a whistleblower in any other arena would get. I think the government should go after NPR for suspending Yuri Berliner. He resigned today, wrote a great resignation letter, and he literally said, I don't support the calls to defund NPR. I am calling for that. I always called for it, but I'm doubling down now. He said, I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and do important journalism. It was a great American institution. I worked there for 25 years. Well, you know, I was once young and beautiful, too. But I'm not anymore, and NPR is no longer a good reporting source. And I don't care if they thrive or don't thrive. I really don't. After everything that they were suppressing, all the information that they suppressed, and we know this is true. It's not like the right is making this up. I mean, we saw the Twitter files. We know that big tech and the government were colluding to shut down any voices that didn't toe the line and say that COVID was not a man-made. It came from Wuhan's wet market. All this crap. Oh, no, you can't question whether or not there's some sort of medical anomalies happening when people are given the vaccines. No, you can't refuse the vaccine. You can be fired. You can't work for the government and refuse the vaccine. You can't be in the military and refuse the vaccine. How about that? They did that. NPR has some culpability in that. Living through lockdowns and seeing the exposure of all the censorship and all the suppression efforts of big tech and these federal agencies, we saw it all in the Twitter files. And by the way, most of the people who exposed those things through their examination of the Twitter files are leftists. Schellenberger, leftist. Barry Weiss, leftist. Nellie Bowes, leftist. Now, they have retreated from the far left because they see how grotesque what went on was. Yeah, Naomi Wolf used to be a leftist. Now, now nobody wants to talk to her anymore because she's saying, wait a second, you know, the COVID vaccine thing, the whole thing was really deceitful and people got hurt. She's persona non grata in her old circles, right? But this is what they've done to themselves. Nobody did this to NPR. Yuri Berliner didn't bring down NPR. NPR became irrelevant by their own hand. And Yuri Berliner thought, well, you know, I have some integrity, so I'm just going to write an article and say, like, maybe you ought to reevaluate how you cover news. If you want to be taken seriously, then you should give all sides an opportunity to speak and let the people decide. You know, I always thought, and let me tell you, when I was young, I listened to NPR, watched PBS and all that other stuff, because back then, there really was only a nightly news report. So if you wanted some sort of in-depth analysis, you had to wait for, you know, 60 minutes or once a week, you could see a show that did a little more in-depth. But public radio and PBS, public broadcasting, used to have the ability to do long-form interviews and things like that. So I definitely watched it when I was young. I stopped watching it when I realized that I never got the whole story. That they would cut off the story when it got inconvenient for them. And by inconvenient, I mean when there was any kind of controversy. Now, as long as I was willing to shake my head, yes, the government is God, then I could listen. But when I wasn't willing to do that anymore, and by the way, I don't think anybody should be willing to do that past the age of 18. When I wasn't able to do it anymore, I stopped listening. And you had the rise of talk radio, which was demolishing NPR, but we had to pay for ourselves. You see, talk radio was doing talk 24/7, had to pay the hosts, just like they had to pay the NPR hosts. But the government didn't cut us any checks. No, we had to go out and sell advertising. We had to find a way to make it profitable, not just for us, but for the shareholders of Clear Channel and Hubbard and all these companies that were willing to put on programming, right? It's a free market economy. We made it work. Not NPR. They could do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, because in the end, they would always be financed by the taxpayer, even if they were giving the taxpayer crap, which they were giving the taxpayer most of the time. So, you know, I think that they should afford some, I don't know, coverage, some protection for Yuri Berliner. I don't know that he wants it or would accept it, but I think it's grotesque what they have done, trying to demean him. All his colleagues like, oh, we're the real deal, and what happened to him, we don't know. Well, yeah, we do know. He took what last shred of dignity he had, and he said, maybe we ought to rethink this model. Boy, did they get ticked off. I want to see how long this mayor lasts, this CEO of NPR, now that Chris Rufo is pulling up all these TED Talks, all these posts of hers, calling Donald Trump a racist, you know, supporting Joe Biden. Look, you can do whatever you want in your private life, but if you're going to be the CEO of National Public Radio and you're going to use my money, conservative tax money, to put on a product, you better be mindful about what you put out there, because we're just going to pillory you when we can. All right, don't forget to download the 850 app on your cell phone or on your laptop, on your desktop, whatever. If not, visit our website, 850wftl.com, so you can participate in a contest or two, and you can also get breaking news and weather alerts and all that good stuff. I'm going to take a quick break. Stay right where you are. I'll be right back.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
So all I can tell you is, you know, I'm watching and waiting because I think that this trial is going to be another example of how Donald Trump gets to expose the most corrupt Department of Justice, the most corrupt series of DAs around the country, certainly in New York, certainly the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, certainly the folks in Atlanta. We're getting to see firsthand just how corrupt and bankrupt these people really are. So there was a guy on, I guess he was on CNN. I saw a clip at the Hill website earlier today where he was talking to Wolf Blitzer, right? And he said, oh, my goodness, you know, if I were one of these jurors, because they picked the first seven jurors yesterday. Now, there's no court today. But by the end of, I don't know, the 5 o'clock hour yesterday, I already knew where the jurors worked, what their gender was, pretty much what their age was. I had a lot of information about those jurors. Does that seem like a really smart idea? Is this not going to be a very intensely followed trial? One in which emotions are flaring already on both sides? I would be concerned about the safety of the jurors. I really would. I don't understand why so much information about them has to be made public. This one reads the New York Times, and that one goes to TikTok for her news. And I'm thinking, this one's an oncology nurse, and this one is a this, and this one. It's not going to take like rocket science to figure out who some of these people are. And as far as I can see, they're not being sequestered. So they got to go to work. Or maybe now that they're going to be sitting on this jury, they don't have to go to work, but people are going to go to their workplace to find out if it's them. And I would imagine that the responsibility for their safety is with the judge and the DA's office, right? It's certainly not, shouldn't be handed over to the defense team. It shouldn't be even expected of the police. The judge and the DA's office really have endangered these jurors. And you'd almost have to say this is how ridiculous our thinking process becomes when we get, you know, roiled and rolled by our Department of Justice over and over again. Did they do that on purpose? What are they looking for? You see, I don't think that even with a jury that's going to be inclined to convict Donald Trump, there is always a possibility that there's somebody sitting on this jury, and perhaps more than one somebody sitting on this jury, who is going to not go along with convicting former president for something that, I don't know, Bill Clinton did. And certainly anybody who's been in the workplace, especially in New York City, knows all about non-disclosure agreements, knows all about company executives paying off people who want to start some garbage. You know, this is not something that only Donald Trump has done, if in fact he has done it. So you have some people who are pretty ticked off on both sides. Okay, I was listening to some of these people on the left. They would like to see Donald Trump in jail. They want to see him in jail for life. Yeah, they're not sympathetic at all to his family or to him. Never were, never will be. The hatred is so deep, it's sick, it's really demented. But you keep pushing people around the way they're pushing people around, you're going to get that one hothead. You know, the audacity. This was really, like, so clear to me. The left, their heads were exploding because Senator Tom Cotton had the audacity, meanwhile, my hero, to go on X or one of these social media sites and say, if some of these protesters, these anti-Semite protesters, get in the way of you going to work, get rid of them, move them. You know, and then he showed a video of some big brawny guy literally picking up these people who had positioned themselves on the roadway so that people couldn't drive to work. And he, like, picked them up and put them off to the side. And it was like a, this is what you should do kind of video. And the left went crazy. Oh, my God, look what he's doing. He's encouraging violence. You know, this, after a sitting congresswoman by the name of Maxine Waters told people, if anybody in the Trump administration, you see them in public, you start something. You go up to them. See, it was okay when she said that. But now this guy's saying, simply remove them from the roadway if they get in your way and you can't get to work or you can't get to the airport or whatever the case may be. They're closing down your bridges. Move them. Pick them up and move them. Most of them are these wimpy, skinny, little Antifa-like characters anyway. I could pick them up and move them. But, oh, what an outrage that he would say that. Not what an outrage that they're trying Donald Trump in this manner. That's not an outrage. Not an outrage that the judge has literally let the whole world know how much he hates Donald Trump. Letitia James let him know. DAs all over the country. It's not just Alvin Bragg. It's not just Fannie Willis. All over the country, we hate him. We're running on a platform of getting Donald Trump. How long do you think people are going to watch this and be passive about it? I looked at a videotape last night. It was really intense. I sent it to a couple of friends. It was the congresswoman who is Ukrainian. She's an American citizen now, but she was born in Ukraine. And she's questioning Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States. And she just gets all up in his face and asks him, do you know that the American public doesn't trust you, doesn't trust the Department of Justice? And he's like, oh, you know, the typical liberal falderal. Well, they can trust us. We're doing all the right things and blah, blah. You know, and she goes, no. You know, let's look at January 6th. She said, apparently, a lot of Americans don't understand why you are doing what you've done to those people who showed up on the Capitol. Like, people in my district went to Washington and they weren't looking for trouble. They went to protest. And somehow you arrest them. But the people who are protesting and shutting down bridges all over the country and airports all over the country, well, they're good guys. It's only people who might support Donald Trump who have to be prosecuted. And it's only Donald Trump who has to be prosecuted. How stupid do you think they are, is what she was saying to Merrick Garland. They don't trust you. And I can see why. I'm from a country where I got to observe firsthand what communists and tyrants and dictators and despots do to people. So here I am in the United States of America. I'm an elected congresswoman, and I don't trust the Department of Justice. I know you're not going to answer my questions, and even if you do, you're not going to answer them. Honestly, that's outrageous. It's outrageous. And that's where we are. So, you know, bully for her. I got to get her name. I watched the videotape like 5 times. I did, because it was just... It was just important to see that we have somebody who's up there in Congress right now who understands how dangerous a moment this is for this country, has lost their country. She mentioned that. And I could, she was so passionate. It really was, if you can find it, let me see if I can pull up her name right now so you can look for it. Victoria Spartz. Her name is Victoria Spartz, S-P-A-R-T-Z. She emigrated to the U.S. in 2000, married an American guy who was born and raised in Indiana or somewhere. She met him on a train. She came here. She's a politician and she was a businesswoman, represents Indiana's 5th Congressional District. So she's in the Midwest now, right? And she had people in her district who went on January 6th to Washington to question the results of an election and got arrested. And she wanted Merrick Garland to explain that to the American people, and he couldn't. And she did not relent. She was passionate. So look it up. Her name is Spartz, S-P-A-R-T-Z. And it is worth watching, because if you're ever if you ever think that nobody up there gets it, Representative Spartz compares fear of the FBI to the way Soviet citizens fear the KGB, right in Merrick Garland's face. It was awesome. All right, let me take a break. You stay right where you are, and I'll be right back. And of course, I'm keeping my eyes on the Middle East. How can anyone not when what's going on is going on? And, you know, like you, I got a ton of emails yesterday and a lot of links, and particularly a few people linked me to the Geller report, Pam Geller's report, and this Reuters report, which claimed that Joe Biden essentially gave Iran the green light to send missiles, cruise missiles and drones and all the rest of it into Israel. And then there was all this kind of mitigation going on in these reports. Well, but they had to measure their response and the this and the that. I kept trying to verify the information. I don't like to go on the air with that kind of stuff because I don't know. Half the time it's it is true and half the time it isn't true, but I don't know which half is which. So I'm still waiting for more confirmation. Now, a lot of Jewish publications, a lot of Jewish newspapers are claiming that, in fact, Joe Biden did give Iran permission. Now, let me just say this. If it turns out that that's true, that's an impeachable offense. That's not maybe an impeachable offense. But if you tell the enemy of our ally to launch a missile attack against our ally with the United States imprimatur, that's an impeachable offense. And it's the kind of treasonous thing that literally would require a trial and a response from Congress. It just would. But again, I don't have any verification of this. All I'm going to say is, if it is true, and if we find out that in fact the President of the United States gave a thumbs up or a green light to Iran and then went to Rehoboth Beach to work on his tan, it is not going to go well for him. Because that is way beyond the pale. Now Iran, the president of Iran, is taunting Israel, telling them that if they do even the tiniest invasion of Iran, there will be a massive and harsh response. Because, of course, they know, just like everybody else knows, that Bibi is preparing a response. That the hardliners, not even just Bibi, but the hardliners in the war cabinet are saying, you know, the clock is ticking and you have to respond. We've been attacked by a nation that wants to destroy us. Death to America is their theme. So they got to be shaking in their, well, I don't know what they wear. I guess the men don't wear burqas, but whatever it is that they wear, they got to be shaking in them. President Raisi spoke at an annual army parade that was moved to a barracks north of Tehran. It's usually on a highway in the city. They didn't say why they relocated. I'll tell you why they relocated it, because Israel could have taken out the whole battalion. State television didn't broadcast it. They usually do. But they're walking circumspect right now. Yes, we were able to shoot down the drones, that we helped to shoot down those drones and those missiles. But what if something had gotten through? Today, Hezbollah, who's just a proxy for Iran anyway, actually launched an attack which resulted in deaths. Hamas has killed hundreds. I was reading an article, or not actually reading an article, I was watching a video blog from someone who is Israeli, Amir Tzafani. And he said that somewhere between 40 and 60 survivors of October 7th have committed suicide. And I was talking about it with someone, and they said to me, well, why would they have committed suicide? And I didn't know if they were kidding when they asked me that, because it didn't seem like a very thoughtful response, and it was a person who's pretty thoughtful. But if you witnessed what they witnessed, you know, when I had one of the young men who, Din Tesler, who was there in working security at the festival, the music festival, when he came to our church and when he was on my show, he talked about watching Hamas burn people and just rape women and break them in half and drag people out of their homes in front of their mothers and fathers, in front of their children, and brutally murder them, burn babies in their cribs. You want to know why they might have committed suicide? How do you live with that? What about the ones who have hostages or who were part of that and their loved one has been a hostage for now all this time? Let me ask you, does anybody in my audience believe that those hostages are alive? Or forget about alive. If they were alive, what condition do you think they're in? I mean, a 2-year-old, a 1-year-old. You can only hope that some kind-hearted woman took the babies. But I assure you, the 22-year-old girls and the 21-year-old men, they're not alive. And if they are, they wish they weren't. Their families would love to have them back, but I'm sure their families are terrified that if they are alive, what have they been through? What will they be like when they're restored to Israel? There's going to be no restraint. I can tell you that right now. Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't care how much taunting the president of Iran does, doesn't care how much the president of the United States tells him, or Antony Blinken or anybody else tells him to exercise restraints. He doesn't care how many financial sanctions Janet Yellen puts into place, how the United Nations is looking for money from the world to help the 3 million Palestinians that they say need aid. No. Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to figure out how he can end this and be victorious. And I think if anybody can, I hope he can. I really believe he can. And I think the world needs to back off and let him. He'd be doing us all a favor. And then I think to myself, the level of anti-Semitism that we're watching everywhere, and in particular for me, watching here in America, tells me that Netanyahu has to win this war. There is absolutely no room for Hamas, Hezbollah, or ISIS-K, or any of these other Houthis, Hezbollah. They've got to be scared to death or wiped out. because I listened to the president of Colombia earlier today, who was trying to challenge the assertion that the school that my daughter went to had allowed itself to become a hotbed of anti-Semitism. Now, of course, it's always referred to as hatred, not anti-Semitism. They don't like to say that, although I think she did say it once during her little speech and how, you know, they're changing all that and they're going to make sure everybody's safe and blah, blah, blah. Nonsense. Nonsense. This is how it always, the Jews are always the canary in the mine. You can kill a lot of Jews before anybody gets upset. Like, you can kill like 5 million. When you get to 6 million, the world starts to pay attention. Well, guess what? Bibi Netanyahu's not going to let them kill 6 million Jews. And neither are, you know, the handful of good politicians that might be left in Washington. You know, poor Speaker Johnson's trying to break out the aid for Israel so that they can reinforce their defenses because they're in a war. You know, all I hear about is, oh, we got to help Ukraine. You have, no. We have an ally in the Middle East that needs our help right now. And all the funding is tied up. Well, guess what? I'm looking to this Congress. I don't care how slim your majority is in the House. The Republicans better get that money to Israel. I don't care if you're in the minority in the Senate. I don't care what the media has to say. It's time for people of good conscience. It's time for people who understand the geopolitical nature of what's going on right now and how it's Israel today, but it's us next. They're coming after you and me. They're coming after Western civilization. This is an ancient battle. It's been going on for millennia. And they have all the time in the world. They don't care how many people die. They don't care how many of their own people die. You know, they hide behind civilians. We, on the other hand, are very nervous. We don't want anyone to get hurt. Well, guess what? War is hell and people get hurt. And as General Patton said, there's only one purpose to a war, and that's to kill the other side. So, I pray for Bibi every day, that he be strengthened and that he find a way to win. He's got to wipe out Hamas, and he's got to make sure that the world sees Iran for who they really are. They are, well, I'd like to keep my job, so I'm just going to stop right there. Don't forget, coming up after me, Eric Erickson, followed by Joe Pags and Lars Larson, the Overnight Guys. And then at 6 a.m., Jen and Bill will be back with the South Florida Morning Show. At 9 o'clock, you have Brian Kilmeade. At noon, it's Dan Bongino. And, of course, I'm always back at 3 o'clock. But I have a segment left today, so don't touch that dial. I'll be right back. So apparently Joe Biden is really worried that Caitlin Clark isn't going to make enough salary. The girl's going to get $3 million in endorsement money. I don't think that her salary is an issue. But he's just so detached. You know, he tries to pretend that Donald Trump, oh my God, Donald Trump's an elitist and I'm just Scranton Joe. Nobody shows up to his events. Nobody cares, really. They hold their nose. If they hate Trump enough, they'll vote for Joe Biden. But there's nobody out there going like, wow, Joe Biden's a great president. No, that's not what the experience has been for the American people. And I'm just patiently waiting to watch Donald Trump, who's been basically, you know, handcuffed. He can't leave New York Monday through Friday. This is not a state or a city that he planned on doing a lot of campaigning in, right? You know, Joe's in Pennsylvania for 3 days. Donald Trump should be in Pennsylvania, right? But he can't go. So I'm watching, and it's amazing. And I know it's not his staff. It's Donald who says, I'm going to a bodega where the guy got arrested for protecting himself because crime is off the charts in New York. And I'm going to speak to that. And I'm going to get national coverage doing it. So even if I'm not in Pennsylvania, the people in Pennsylvania who are getting, you know, mugged and who are afraid to walk out of their houses at night are going to see me at the bodega. And they're going to think, like, you know, I wish we could go back to a time where I felt safe walking out of my house at 8 o'clock at night. He's clever. You know, he did the bodega yesterday. Let's see where he goes today. But trust me, Donald Trump will campaign nationally from New York City. And he'll do it in a suit and tie. And he's lost some weight, so he actually looks pretty fit. You know, and if he falls asleep in court, who can blame him? But I think that there's going to be, like I said this on Monday, and I'm going to say it again. I'll probably say it two or three times a week. Not because I'm so confident, but because I want credit if I'm right. This is going to end in a mistrial. There's just too many things that could go wrong. And you're in New York with a pretty creepy judge and a lousy district attorney and a really smart defendant with some decent lawyers, but a really smart defendant. So I have zero confidence in there being a conviction, which is great for me, great for you, because he may spend 6 weeks off the campaign trail, but he will use this to his advantage, as only Donald Trump can. So I thank you for your time this time. Until next time, my plan is to be back here tomorrow at 3 p.m., if it be his will and he delays his coming. In the meantime, remember that what lies behind us and what lies ahead of us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. So wherever you are, just be yourself. Everybody else is taken. And then pray for Bibi and pray for Israel. God bless Israel. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America. See you tomorrow at 3.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.